History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we really ought to listen to. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. One of the things we're going to learn today is being in your mid-90s is not too late to publish a book. Because our guest today has done that, Charles Bailey, 96 years old, of Fresno, California, our guest. We're going to hear about his days in the Navy during World War II aboard an attack transport. But let's go back a little further. So you were born here in the San Joaquin Valley, Kerman, California?
Yes, I was born near Kerman, California, on July the 5th, 1922.
How do you remember your childhood? What are the things that stand out to you?
I thought it was pretty pleasant considering conditions we lived in. I got along good with the neighbor kids, and we lived across the street from the Kornoffs, and I played with the Kornoff kids a lot, and I remember that's when I took my first steam bath, and I actually learned to speak a few words of Russian. But then when my dad lost his job, we had to move east to live with my mother's mother. It wasn't quite as pleasant back there because we had to live on our own. In other words, you planted what you ate and you didn't buy everything from the grocery store. We were hit by the Great Depression and the Great Drought. We had some cattle. There was no feed for them because of the drought. The government bought them up as surplus. My dad drove all of our cattle into Warsaw, the county seat. The government gave him so much for each animal, and that's how we got the money to come back to California.
And most of us have never lived through a time like that, at least not in our country. Did it feel uncertain to you, or were you too young to know any different?
I felt some uncertainty because I didn't know what is going to happen next. What will I do? Where I learned that I didn't like farming very well, so I had to think of something else. And we came back to California. I was way behind. Their standards were only 6 months a year for school. So I lost more than a year back there. And when I came out here, I was really behind. It was a 3-R school. I had arithmetic, writing, and reading. And I didn't know much. Kids were playing strange games that I didn't understand. I didn't understand baseball because back there we used trees for bases and things like that. It was pretty simple. And they played some game that they call football, and I couldn't understand that. We were hitting each other and throwing passes. But I made the adjustment and was able to get into the fifth grade.
I know this is a long time ago, but you seem to have a pretty sharp memory. So I'm curious if you can take yourself back to that fifth grader or sixth grader or seventh grader. What did you dream about? What were your ambitions? What did you say, hey, when I grow up, here's what I want to do?
I wasn't certain what I wanted to do. I wanted to get a good education, but I didn't know what I wanted to do when I got it. I just knew one thing. I don't want anything to do with farming.
Was that because your dad had you do some farm jobs and you didn't like them, or what?
Yes. When we were in Missouri, we had to run the farm the way my grandmother wanted it. And I know my dad, with his pruning shears, went out and pruned the peach trees. And my grandmother saw that. Oh, you have ruined those trees. So it wasn't too pleasant. And then I know my mother worried a lot because, well, most kids didn't even get to high school. And she was worried about our education, too. So she wanted to get out of there, although she had been born there. And my dad was glad to get out. We were all glad to get out, really.
So you came back here to the San Joaquin Valley in California with your father, your mother, and your younger brother.
Still remember, we came, I guess, the southern route, Route 66, it was originally called. By the way, my father's family were the first immigrants to use that road. And when we got to High Point, and it was just getting dark evening, I could see those palm trees. I still remember that. That looked so good.
So you're back here, and, you know, we're getting through the 30s and on into the early 40s. What kind of things were you up to?
I guess the things boys are usually up to during those years. One hobby I developed that I spent quite a bit of time with, collecting arrowheads. A pot digger, you might call us. We're amateurs. There's some of the ones I still have. So that's one thing that I did.
Where'd you find those? I mean, you've got a nice collection of arrowheads there. How do you pick those up?
You really have to look for them. You're focused and you're looking down. Normally, you wouldn't see a lot of them. But when you go arrowhead hunting, you're looking for that. And that's how I found most of them. And there's another kid and I that did this.
So is that in the Kings River or where?
In the Osage River, most of them. Some of them are collected here. In both states, I've collected arrows.
So your mom wanted you to come back here for educational purposes. You finished high school here, and you actually went to college, right?
Yes. I finished elementary school here. Graduated from Alameda Elementary School. We were in the Reedley School District, so I went to Reedley from high school. And I went 3 years to Reedley.
At this time, did you have any indication that America might be swept into a war?
None. But I was very interested in what was going on in Europe. I know the first thing that my brother and I did when we got off the bus was go to the house and turn on the radio and listen to the latest war news, never dreaming that I would be in that war. Well, no one thought that. That was absolutely impossible. No way. The Germans aren't going to attack France with the largest army in the world, Britain with the greatest fleet. They'll never do it until the Blitzkrieg that took France out. That next to Pearl Harbor, that was probably the biggest shock. That turned everything around. Then we started thinking about war factories, drafts, a peacetime draft. Rick, can you imagine that? We were making preparations at the time of Pearl Harbor, but we still had a long ways to go.
And by the time that happened, you were already in college. What were you studying at Fresno State?
Well, my mother thought I should take up merchandising, and I did. I didn't. I saw that that was not the thing for me because my background was in farming. I never worked in a clothing store or anything like that before. So I wasn't too interested in that. I thought I would switch over to teaching maybe. But when I looked at my teaching schedule, I didn't like some of the classes. And so I was complaining to the campus policeman there. And he said, well, why don't you come over and join us? So I did. That's where I got my degree.
But before you could get a degree, you had this little thing called World War II that Uncle Sam had some work for you.
I was in the Navy for 3 years, so all the people with whom I started, they were graduated and gone. That seemed there was no one at the university except veterans recently released. There was about 3 men to every woman, I think, there. Anyway, I had quite a bit of fun with criminology because we could work a few jobs and get a little money. Of course, I still had my GI, or I wouldn't have been going to college.
You know, I was struck in flipping through your book, Bell Bottom Trousers, that you had a very vivid description of what Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941, was like here in the San Joaquin Valley, complete with the fog and this mantle over the valley. What do you remember about that day, and how did you find out?
I was a freshman at Fresno State. This was near the end of the first semester for me in college. I got in kind of on probation. My grades weren't the greatest, but I did pretty well. I surprised myself. You know, I like college life. Hey, this is a lot better than high school. So we lived out in the country. So I didn't have a car. So I stayed with my uncle in town, and my mother would pick me up Monday mornings and take me to the college. So that Sunday morning, generally my mother would go to church quite often. My dad, not so often, but for one reason, he worked 6 days a week. He had only one day to work for other things. So that day, my dad said to my brother and I, "We're going to fix this pig house," for we had one sow that was about ready to deliver, so we wanted to get a good roof on it. About 11 o'clock, my brother said, "I have to go to the bathroom." He went to the house, and my mother was listening to some religious program, and all of a sudden, the program just switched. All of the stations went to the war news. And my brother came running out to where my dad and I were working and said that we're at war. He said, "The Japs have attacked Pearl Harbor." We threw down our tools and went in the house and sat in front of the radio until about midnight, I think, trying to learn what had happened. We couldn't believe it. It didn't penetrate that they would do something like that, because everything seemed to be going pretty good. We were recovering from the Depression, but this changed the whole world, of course.
I'm sure it changed your world quite a bit, too. Did you realize that at the time, that it was going to change your world?
Yes, I began to think about that. But I probably couldn't have joined anyway, because if you went to a recruiting station, they would be a line a mile long of people. So I thought, I've got time to maybe finish the second semester. But that was a disaster, because I couldn't focus on my studies. And everyone you'd meet, all we talked about was war news. We just couldn't focus. So my grades were the worst I ever got. And I thought I might get kicked out if it wasn't for the war. And most of the young men were leaving, you know, different times. Oh, they got all of the first recruits in to the service until about June. That's when they thought about using the draft. Well, I got a little card in the mail telling me to go to a certain place and register for the draft. And I knew what the others were experiencing. Once you registered for the draft, you had about 2 months and you'd be gone. So I couldn't go back to college. And if I didn't do something pretty quick, I'd be in the Army. And I didn't want that at all. So I joined the Navy. And I'm glad I did.
How did your parents feel about it?
They felt I made the right decision. We were sworn in and then sent to San Diego boot camp. And it took us all day. We'd stop at stations and we'd pick up other recruits. Every time we stopped at a station, there would be ladies there with sandwiches and coffee. So I felt, this is pretty good. We were treated like kings. We finally got to San Diego. It was about 11 o'clock at night. But anyway, we had to have our first Navy lecture. One thing he warned us about, he says, the U.S. Navy is not a part of the democratic system. We would have learned that in a couple days on our own. But he informed us that we had to call him sir. We were a bunch of landlubbers and didn't know anything about that.
Well, speaking of, that question occurred to me. Had you ever in your life been on a ship before?
No. No idea what a ship was like.
Did you have an idea in your mind of the kind of ship that you wanted to end up on?
Yes. I wanted to be on a battleship or a cruiser. I even would have settled for a destroyer. But being put on a troop transport, just like the one I came over on, I was really disappointed. But that the troop ships that took us to the war zones was a civilian ship working under contract for the Navy. So we had the civilian crew, but we were in the Navy. Right after Pearl Harbor, Churchill and Roosevelt got together, and they spent almost 3 weeks planning their strategies, and they decided that they would do Europe first. Then when we finished Europe and Italy, we would go over to the Pacific and take care of Japan. But they forgot that all that time Japan would be free. It could do what she wanted to. So she began taking one island after the other. And we in the United States, I guess, thought that was all right. We're going to get those people when we get through with Europe. We'll have a huge army. to take care of the Japanese. But the Japanese, they had practically no opposition. All they had to do was land on the island, and they started moving southward, and they captured Tulagi. So the Japanese built a sea base at Tulagi. That was mostly, we thought, for reconnaissance. But some of the natives noticed that Japanese were building a large base right across from Tulagi on the island called Guadalcanal. We still didn't think too much of it. That wasn't in our plans at all. But as they went south, their objective, of course, was to cut the supply lines between New Zealand and Australia. And when these New Zealanders and Australians, ASAC troops we call them, heard about this, they demanded action from the British. Give us some protection here, or they would fall to the Japanese. And they backed it up with a threat. If Britain didn't do something about it, they were going to bring all of their ANZAC troops home. And at the time, the Egyptian-Libyan campaign was going on, and the British had some success, but then they had to make a deal to send something else in there. Then they wanted us to do Guadalcanal, get the Japs off of there. But they found that that was not so easy because we'd already made plans for Europe. We realized that we couldn't land on France. What they needed was practice, so they decided we'll do North Africa. Supplies were still scarce. They lauded most of their supplies for the African campaign in North Africa, and they didn't want to then have to go clear across the ocean and do Guadalcanal. But we had to do it, and that's where several million of us spent the war years, from Guadalcanal, of course, to Tokyo.
And we'll hear about some of those adventures when we come back. Charles Bailey of Fresno, California, our guest today. Link to his book, Bell Bottom Trousers, at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors. Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Charles Bailey, 96 years old, of Fresno, California, where he had a long career in law enforcement and in his later years has become an author. He recently published Bell Bottom Trousers, complete with the story of the attack transport he served on during World War II, the USS President Adams, making multiple landings in the Pacific.
We practiced at San Diego, and then that's where we gathered the ships and the troops and sent them over. We didn't make the invasion right away. We went to Tonga Tabu and practiced there. We would be fairly close, but not close enough for Japanese observers or European spies to detect us. And we did make the landing in secrecy. The Japanese, the first telegram they sent back to Tokyo was that the American force, they said, of about 1,000 men, and the Japanese government deducted that that's probably a major reconnaissance raid, and they will destroy everything and then go home. But there was one admiral saw all that stuff, and he said that this ain't no reconnaissance raid. This is an invasion. He was in charge of the squadron in that area. So he just gathered his hips, and the second night of the invasion, he sneaked in, and this was the Battle of Savo Island. This was the worst defeat the United States had ever suffered before. The reason for it was the people in charge of the campaign. The man in charge decided to establish his base at Noumea, New Caledonia. That left the second in charge, Admiral Fletcher, who was in charge of all of the aircraft carriers and second in command to the whole business. Fletcher decided that he didn't have enough fuel to stay more than 2 days. After 2 days, he pulled all of his aircraft to refuel, probably 1,000 miles away. So we had no air cover, and the ships had to disperse. About half of the force was on the island, but we didn't have the troops and supplies to do what we wanted to do then, was to take the island, secure it, because there was really no one on the island except Korean laborers, mostly, guarded by a few Japanese. But Admiral Makawa didn't waste any time, and by this time the Japanese government decided it's an invasion. They began sending troops as fast as they could. Large troop ships landed on Guadalcanal, and we couldn't push them off. We had to go on defense instead of offense. We did capture the airfield, and the Japanese, of course, pushed us from both sides. They wanted to recapture it. So the Battle of Guadalcanal was really over who controlled the air, Henderson Field, we named it. So instead of securing Guadalcanal and get the thing over with, we were playing defense. And we couldn't get supplies to Guadalcanal because they controlled, they brought their aircraft carriers down so they could land back in the carrier. So anyway, they became well entrenched during this period. And the Battle of Savo Island destroyed most of our capital ships. No battleships were involved, but several cruisers and destroyers. So we really didn't have a naval force able to take the offense. We had to protect every ship that went to Guadalcanal, so the troops on Guadalcanal didn't have the things that they needed. One of the things that they needed the most, they found out, was barbed wire, and they had very little barbed wire, so they had to send a couple destroyers to one of the ships that was carrying barbed wire and bring it. So we learned a lesson about military loading supply, because the ships, when they were in the States, they brought them aboard as they came, but they had to learn a different system. Combat loading, that's where you would put your, like, ammunition and things that you needed right away near the top of the hole, not down on the bottom. So a lot of the ships, when they started unloading, found out that their macaroni was on top and the shells were down the bottom. We learned combat loading, so we could unload our ship in one day. But we didn't know this then. That's another lesson we learned. The Japanese would come at night and bring supplies, and we shut them off. The big ships couldn't get in. They sent 11 transports down, and I think only 4 of them got through. They couldn't get back, so they beached the ships and at least got their supplies, which lasted them a while. But pretty soon, we really beat them by starvation, mostly, because they couldn't get the supplies. At night, they would send, this is called the Tokyo Express, about 8 or 9 destroyers with maybe 1 light cruiser, but they could only land supplies about, we figured, 2 days that those supplies would be gone. The Japanese called it their rat line. But we fought several battles with the Japanese, all night battles. Now, the Japanese didn't have radar at that time, but they specialized in night fighting. And they had a torpedo that was much superior to ours and much larger. They did most of the damage with their torpedoes. Sometimes we won, but usually we lost.
A lot of ships were lost. A lot of crew were lost. But let's talk about you personally and what you experienced. Was there kind of a welcome to the war moment? Was there an incident where you saw firsthand what this was going to be like?
I thought it would be easy, like most Americans, because we thought that the Japanese were little people who couldn't make anything on their own. They made poor copies of other people's products, which wasn't the case. They had their torpedoes were very effective, while ours were defective. So that gave them a big advantage. But still, they won most of the night battles. But finally, it was costing the Japanese so much that they made the decision to withdraw. I was still there when they helped. I could hear the artillery at night, but it was coming to an end. And then gradually, our next job was to get the Marines, who were equipped for about a 2 or 3 week fighting, who'd been there 6 months. They were in bad shape. I remember the first load we took off were the Marines. Some of them we had to help up the deck. I've never seen such a ragged, worn-out outfit in my whole life. But yet, their morale was great. So we took them to Australia, where we turned them over to... We lent them, in other words, to MacArthur, because he didn't have troops that he could use.
What were your duties on the ship? What was your role?
I was a seaman. We had to try to keep everything in order above deck. And also, we had to furnish them food, hospitalization. You can imagine, with about a battalion, about 1,400 troops aboard a medium-sized ship. We were 10,000 tons, I think, empty. But with a full load, we had 16,000 tons. And we had to sustain these troops for anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks. And the ship was a mess to try to take care of all those people. By the way, every day we would have several burials at sea. The Marines conducted these. They would put the body in a sack, kind of. We had lots of canvas. Put them in a canvas, put a 5-inch shell at the bottom, and gently roll them over the side while the Marine band played the music, the funeral music. So that kind of made it a happy trip and a sad trip. Happy because we were going to Liberty Port, but sad for those Marines who wouldn't make it.
What about if general quarters sounded on your ship? Where did you have to go?
Well, I changed a couple times. Originally, my general quarters station was in the stern with a gun platform which was built up. You had to climb a ladder to get up there. We were not a warship. We were a supply ship, really. We didn't have turrets or large guns. We had open guns, 3-inch open guns, 2 on each side. No, 4, 8 men. 2 would be standing watching on duty while the other 2 would be resting. And it was the same way on the other side. Up front, it was the same figuration. So we would watch for 2 hours for anything unusual, or mostly we were interested in submarines to spot them. So that's the way it was. My job was I set the fuse. We had a few ready boxes where we had the shells, but then most of them would have to come up from down below, and it was my job when they came up to set the fuse at a, we were told what setting, 5 or 6 seconds. Then I would pass it on to the next carrier, who would give it to the gunner. When the breech opened, he would shove it up real quick like that so it wouldn't get his hand caught. So that was our defense in the early part of the war. Later, I was transferred to the 1st Division up in front, and I was put on a 20-millimeter. Or 4 men on a 20-millimeter. There was the gunner. He had to, if the enemy was overhead, he would have to flex his knees and get down like this almost and fire. And we had 2 loaders, one on each side, because the ammunition for 20-millimeter came in a coil, 60 shells in each coil, and every 4th or 5th one would be an incendiary. So my job, I wore the headphones. I got the messages from the bridge and conveyed them to the crew. So my job then was fairly easy.
Well, I'm sure it's easier when waters are smooth and no one's shooting at you, but I'm sure that wasn't always the case. What are some of the incidents you remember that you look back on and say, hey, that was a little bit hairy?
Well, probably the first one was when I saw this Japanese torpedo plane. They had converted their twin-engine plane to torpedo bombers. When I looked, I saw this plane that had been shot down, but motors were functioning. He was still moving. and I could see the crew members through the plexiglass. They were that close to us. And of course, generally, if they saw that they couldn't make it, they would sacrifice the ship. Now, of course, this was against international law, except if you had no other way, knew that you weren't going to get picked up or anything, we could do this. A couple examples where we crashed into Japanese ships or other things. But all this is just a first battle. We're just getting warm now. We do this for about 2 more years, and it became more kind of a routine. Actually, us younger guys, to me, I like this sort of life. It's fun.
A couple things you point out there that at this point, this is still fairly early in the war, so this phenomenon of the kamikazes, the suicide attacks, was not something that you're aware of yet. But finish that story for me. What did that Japanese plane do? Where did it end up?
They would we would give them some more ammunition. We would, every gun on that side would fire at him until he sank. They were in our territory, so they had no way of rescuing their pilots. They thought, we'll use our best pilots. So pretty soon, all their best pilots were dead. They had to train new men, and they had to do it quickly, and the quality of their aircraft dropped tremendously. In fact, these torpedo bombers that I was talking about, we got so good at shooting them down that we called them Zippos. After the Zippo lighter, you light a cigarette with your Zippo lighter. We would call these planes Zippos, because pretty soon they would be on fire. So their success, daylight success, didn't work. They tried it once to do it at night, but it was much more difficult, and the results were pretty bad. But gave me this was the scariest point in my life. In my first real battle, I had just transferred to another division, so they didn't have a place. They forgot that the people in the boats, they stayed in their boats during general quarters, but all people without a specific place to go to would go below deck. One evening we were watching the beautiful sundown. All of a sudden, someone saw this parachute coming down. He said, "That's Japanese parachute." About that time, the alarm went off, so I had no place to go, so I went down in the hole with all the others. Our 3-inch guns started firing, and every time they fired, the ship would shake. And I thought, sure, they've got a hit, that we will soon be at the bottom of the Pacific. That's a scare. I came back on deck. No damage at all. All that shaking and stuff was just caused by the recoil of the guns.
There would be some close calls to come, and we'll hear about those from 96-year-old Charles Bailey when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, "Send me." Some hear, "It can't be done," and say, "I'll do it." Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
When her sailor went to see what he could see, she saw that he ate spinach, now he's big as he can be. When he's home they stroll along, they don't give a hoot. She won't let go of his hand even to salute. If her sailor she can't find on the bounding main, she is hopeful he will soon come home safe again. So they can get married and raise a family, dress up all their kiddies in sailor's dungarees.
Oh, bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor and he loves her too.
Bell Bottom Trousers, as performed by Guy Lombardo and his orchestra in 1945 and seared into the brain of sailors like Charles Bailey ever since. Bell Bottom Trousers is the name of the book recently published by this 96-year-old veteran of World War II. You can link to the book online at hometownheroesradio.com. It tells his story, but also details the exploits of his ship, the attack transport USS President Adams, starting early in the war with the Battle for Guadalcanal.
While we were still evacuating Guadalcanal, the Army was coming in. The Army replaced the Marines. So coming back from New Zealand, and we were unloaded and didn't have all these troops, and it was really pleasant. We'd go down in the hole number two and play basketball. But coming back to Noumea, we had to sail, of course, the Tasman Sea, which is noted for its stormy weather. We hit some weather that was rough. I remember one storm that was so rough that we couldn't hardly stand up. As war went on, it got better and better for us, so we were safer until almost the end, when the Japanese decided their only hope was to use the kamikazes. That started a new war, because we really didn't have any defense against that. You could shoot a lot of the planes down, but if you shot them all down but one, that plane might crash your ship. So that's why it was so dangerous in the Philippines and Iwo Jima.
Did that change your sense of security? Did you feel more frightened, or was it more unnerving when that kamikaze threat became so evident?
Not real bad, because it got worse all the time. We didn't do Okinawa. That was the worst one. That was, as far as ships concerned, that was the worst one. After Iwo Jima, when the ships came back, I was transferred back to the States. So we missed Okinawa, but we did do Iwo Jima. It wasn't too bad for the Navy, but for the Marines, it was hell. It was the bloodiest day of the war for the Pacific. But we were anchored quite a ways off. We had 498 ships, I believe, to spread around the damage. So for us, it wasn't really that bad. But it was total disaster for the first Marine units would hit the beach. It was bad for us, too, in the fact that we were in the middle of the ocean. There was no harbor on Iwo Jima, so we were subject to all of the waves and stuff, and this was hard. But actually, as far as being hit by a shell or anything, we were pretty lucky. We did lose a few ships.
You know, you mentioned how hard it was on the Marines, and the whole purpose of your ship is to deliver the Marines and evacuate them. So you have all these landing craft that are on your ship that are taking the Marines to shore. And then I'm sure you saw some of those Marines coming back aboard who had been wounded on Iwo Jima. Yeah.
We buried quite a few of them. But I forgot to tell you about our ship, though, how they served us at Guadalcanal. The Navy recognized this, that we were under a stress that most of the bigger ships were not under, because we had to land all of our own troops with our own boats. We had to take care of them. We had to feed them. We had to treat them when they were sick. You know, now, it's not like a normal, like World War One, that the big transport would pull up to the dock. The men get off in an orderly manner. This wasn't like that. We had to stay there. And we also had to keep ammunition and supplies coming in. So we were there 10 days. And during that, and it was cold. You wouldn't believe how cold it was. So that was probably our roughest campaign. But then the Navy decided that these ships, we were closer to the Japanese than anyone, because they were just right over there on the beach, that they would divide the transports into two parts. The APs were large ships. They came to the ports with docks. Then we picked them up and took them to the beach and unloaded them in our boats at the beach, kept them supplied in our Higgins boats. For special recognition, they gave us another A. Normally, a transport was AP, but we were APA. The first A stood for auxiliary. Nobody liked that term, so we would never put APA on the bow of our ship. We would put PA. That meant the ship's personnel attacked, and that word attack meant a lot to us. We felt we were playing a bigger part than the warships because we got closer to the enemy than anyone else.
When you're aboard ship and one of these LCVPs comes back with wounded or dead Marines, how hard was that to witness? How much of a shock or jolt to your system was that to be such a young man and looking at that?
Oh, it was one of the worst episodes I think I ever went through. Not the worst, but it was a bad one. The only time we really lost ship's personnel was at the Bougainville, which was the last of the Solomon's campaign. We landed at a place where the Japanese didn't think that we would land there because most of their troops were over on the other side of the islands near the airports. But they did have some troops there, and they were all zeroed in, their guns were. And one of our Higgins boats was fully loaded. A shell hit right in the middle, killed or wounded everybody there, I think. Not everyone. But anyway, we gathered up the bodies, and also some of the Marines were still there, brought them back aboard ship, and the captain decided we're going to bury these bodies as soon as we could get out to sea. But our command ship, when he saw that flag that said that we are burying our dead, he said, no, he said, take those bodies back to Guadalcanal. We had no morgue. We had no place to store the bodies except the holds where the food was stored. It was only a 24-hour run, and we were almost out of supplies anyway, so the captain had to keep those bodies aboard ship until he got to Guadalcanal. The reason for that, he was told by his superiors, it's because their bodies, if they were buried on Guadalcanal, could later be transferred to the States. Now, this is another thing, a big deal, lecture all by itself. But we did recover a lot of bodies back to the States that were killed there.
Your ship delivered a lot of those bodies that were identified and brought back.
We had to have those bodies aboard for 24 hours down where our food would normally be. That was sort of a thing that kind of got to us.
I can imagine a lot of these things getting to you. I do have to ask, and if it's a dumb question, I apologize. Did you ever fear, did you ever have the concern that something like that could happen to you, that you wouldn't be coming back to the States?
We knew those things happened, But that wouldn't happen to us. It would happen to other people, maybe. So the answer to that would be, I guess, we never thought much about that. But my most dangerous moment, I think, was at Guam, because it's the Navy's duty to deliver the troops and all of their supplies to the troops. So we had to send people ashore to man these stations and make everything. We were really more like policemen. So I thought that'd be kind of a nice thing to do, too. It had quite a bit of prestige to it, too, which we like. So I joined, and we went in right after the first wave. The first wave goes in and clears enough of the beach. Then the beach party would go in, and we would mark our beach with large banners and flags. We used the color system, but in Europe they used states, Utah Beach, what was it, and all of those. So we went in. Guam has a lot of reefs around it. You cannot, most of the time, drive a Higgins boats through there. So we had to go to the reef, unload, and then we would get on these amphibious tractors to go the rest of the way in. So we transferred to, when we got to the beach, we noticed water spouts around us. And someone said, hey, those are Japanese greetings to us. But we got ashore safely, and then we were told to, first thing to dig foxholes, but not too close to each other, so they couldn't wipe half of us out with one hit. So I decided to build my foxhole kind of close to the ocean, and as I would dig, the water kept seeping about in, and we had these big land crabs, and they would fight us. It was their territory, and they wanted to keep it, so we had to fight them. But we finally got in, and then our duty started. I was a messenger to the beachmaster, and I had to go all over the beach to give messages, and dug my foxhole. It was about midnight, I guess. Oh, I think about 1 a.m. When we dispersed. I had a lot of trouble finding my foxhole. For this campaign, we had rifles, 05 rifles, which was a surprise. Of course, I made a little noise, and one of our guys saw me. He knew Japanese attacked at night, so he pointed his gun at me, but he couldn't. We'd never fired these things. This is nighttime. He couldn't find how to fire, so that's why I'm alive today. Wow. He could have killed me dead.
And that's what he was trying to do. He just couldn't pull it off.
Yeah, he thought it was Japanese. We had never thought of that before. And also part of the night, the Marines, the Japanese, did make one of their banzai charges, and the Marines called for help. Our ships were the artillery. The duty battleships and cruisers came closer to the beach, fired at the Japanese right over our heads. We could hear shells going in, and some landed pretty close to us. So that was kind of scary, too. I don't think I ever got back to sleep after that. So that was probably the closest I ever came. Also, another raid while I was on duty delivering messages. You'd jump in a foxhole as soon as you could. So I saw a foxhole. I went and jumped into it. There's already a Marine in it. So I started to apologize. When I looked around, my friend didn't have any head. Boy, I got out of that hole, found another one. But that was probably my really closest calls.
Did that change your mind about being part of the beach party? Did it not seem so alluring anymore?
Well, the next invasion, I was not a member of the beach party. After Guam, we did Iwo Jima. That was pretty rough. But by then, they had improved things. At Iwo Jima, we were able to fly wounded troops, some of them out to bigger stations like Guam and Saipan. So this helped a lot, too. But still, it was pretty bad. From what they told us, these guys would fight at night. They would crawl out of their caves with knives, slip into a Marine's foxhole, and stab him to death.
While you were out there on the ship for all that time, did you ever hear from your family back home?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the Navy was very good at this, at a high cost, too. You remember that mail was put in a heavy manila sack with a metal lock on it? And those things were heavy, and we always look forward to our mail. Next to Liberty was mail. If you were on duty, they would deliver the mail on your bunk. They photographed the letters, not email, V-mail, Victory Mail. And the guys, of course, you expected to get a lot of mail from girls, so they nicknamed V-mail, mail from my female. That was what they called it.
Well, speaking of females, you're closing in on your 70th wedding anniversary, but I'm guessing you didn't meet Mary till you got home from the war and went back to Fresno State?
I met her about 2 months before I graduated. Took that long to get a girlfriend at Fresno State during that period.
Well, how did you two meet?
When I transferred to criminology, it was a new course, and we're trying to get women to join. We got two women. Mary had a friend that she run around with. They met in 38 when they were in the second grade. Joyce joined the crim. Mary was an art major, so they differed there. So we crim majors would eat in the back of the student union. And so Joyce brought Mary with her and introduced her. Thought no more about it. But 2 or 3 days afterwards, I decided I'd wanted to do some library work, so I figured I would eat at the cafeteria and go over to the library. I'd leave my books in the car, and when I went to put my books in the car, I saw her coming down the sidewalk. I said, why don't I ask her to come? I didn't want to eat by myself. She said she would, but I would have to take her home because she would miss her bus, and her parents would, of course, have to be notified. So that's how we met.
Have you ever figured out what the secret is to being married for that long?
Well, we fight like cats and dogs. But there's one thing, never carry a grudge. If you carry a grudge, you're not going to be married very long. So usually 2 or 3 hours it's fixed. And that's the main reason, I think, toleration.
You wrote this book. It's a thorough account of your ship's history in the war and an example of what other APAs went through during the war. Why does this matter? Why is it important that here in 2019 we know about what happened from 1941 to 45?
Well, we're just now learning about some of the things that happened during the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. There are magazines, books. Oh, I believe there are more books about Abraham Lincoln than any person except Christ. Anyway, I think World War II will cover a far greater area than the Civil War, and there'll be 100 years from now, there'll be World War II clubs. Just like there's Civil War, I belong to the Civil War Roundtable, where we study battles, Civil War battles, and the era that that happened, and I think that the same thing will happen in World War II. Because when I came home from the Navy, I was surprised that civilians had to do all these things. My mother had a pot of rancid grease on the stove, and I asked her, Mother, what's that for? And she says, we save all of our grease until we get a container full. We take it to a station, and they pay us a little money. We're doing our civic duties. Kids were out picking up tinfoil. And just about everything you could think of, they suffer too. And every time the postmaster or postman or maybe a car drives up, you think that maybe it's the Navy notifying you that your son has been killed. The stress of, I think, that the civilians went through was almost equal to what the men fighting went through.
I'm hoping that people will order your book, since we're telling about it here. Bell-Bottom Trousers, Charles W. Bailey, Life Aboard an Attack Transport in the Pacific During World War II. So, if somebody's listening right now and they decide to order this book, what are they going to read? What are you hoping that they get out of that experience of reading this book?
I hope they will, number one, appreciate what this generation did and how we succeeded after the terrible licking we received at Pearl Harbor and made this country even better. To number one, numero uno now, while a few years before, Our army was even smaller than Switzerland's. So I think we did a lot. One reason is that I think the GI Bill of Rights gave us a lot. I wouldn't have a college education if it wasn't for the Bill of Rights. I was especially proud of my ending there. My country treated me well. I can remember my uncles complaining about the abusive manner in which they were treated after World War I. They were discharged with no benefits whatsoever, except for a vague promise of a bonus sometime into the distant future. And they had to almost go to war against the government to get this little promise. We veterans of World War II were treated like no other veterans of our country's wars, before or after.
Well, Mr. Bailey, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Thanks for putting it in print with Bell Bottom Trousers. Don't forget to link to the book and photos of Mr. Bailey online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors. Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors. To talk to a local Army career counselor, call
555-9323-1099. Once there was a little girl who lived next to me, and she loved a sailor boy, he was only three. Now he's on a battleship in his sailor suit, just a great big sailor, but she thinks he's very cute.
With his bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor, and he loves her too.
Sailor boys away on the ocean blue, soldier boys all flirt with her, but to him she's true. Though they smile and tip their caps and they wink their eyes, she just smiles and shakes her head, then she softly sighs.
Oh, bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor.
When her sailor went to see what he could see, she saw that he ate spinach, now he's big as he can be. When he's home they stroll along, they don't give a hoot, she won't let go of his hand even to salute. If her sailor she can't find on the bounding main, she is hopeful he will soon come home safe again. So they can get married and raise a family, dress up all their kiddies in sailor's dungarees.
Oh, bell-bottom trousers, coat of navy blue, she loves her sailor and he loves her too.